Listen, there has never been a better time to invest in self-storage, and there's no better team than ours to show you how to do it, because we wrote the book on how to invest in self-storage. Literally, we created the best-selling home study system titled How to Find, Evaluate, Purchase, and Manage Self-Storage Facilities. We have helped thousands of people launch and scale their self-storage business and have become the nation's go-to resource for all things self-storage. That's because we not only talk the talk, we walk the walk, day in and day out since 2005 through now, two recessions and amassing a 2.5 million square feet of self-storage, totaling over 15,000 doors nationwide. There is nobody else that has more experience in self-storage that is teaching people how to invest in self-storage. So if you're ready to launch and scale your self-storage business, then go to selfstorageinvesting.com. Click on the events tab to grab your ticket to the upcoming Self-Storage Academy. So that again is selfstorageinvesting.com. Click on the events tab. Seating is limited. And on behalf of our team, we look forward to seeing you then. Take care. This is the Self-Storage Podcast, where we share the knowledge and skills from the industry's leading investors, developers, and operators to help you launch and grow your self-storage business. Your host, Scott Myers, over the past 16 years, has acquired, developed, converted, and syndicated over 2 million square feet of self-storage nationwide with the help of his incredible team at selfstorageinvesting.com, who has helped thousands of people achieve greatness in self-storage.
Hello, Storage Nation, and welcome back to the Self-Storage Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Myers, and this week's guest is Randy Smith. Randy is the founder of Impact Equity, which was formed to help investors achieve strong results in their passive real estate efforts. Randy currently resides in Peoria, Arizona, with his wife, Jenny, and has spent the last 25 years working in various business development and leadership roles in corporate America prior to starting his real estate investing career in out-of-state, single-family, long-term rentals. And he quickly realized the benefits of passively investing in commercial, multifamily, self-storage, and mobile home syndications. Since then, Randy has invested in 18 different syndications with 8 different operators, which has given him a unique perspective on how to recognize strong passive opportunities. And on this episode, that's indeed what we do, is we tap into Randy's wealth of knowledge and how he looks at investments and how he vets his sponsors when investing in these passive opportunities. So without further ado, please welcome my guest, Randy Smith. Randy Smith, so good to see you again. Welcome to the show.
Awesome, Scott. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to jump into this conversation.
Well, I'm looking forward to it as well. You know, after our last conversation, I thought it was appropriate to share you and the discussion that we had with Storage Nation. So I've given everyone a little bit of your bio and your background, but if you would, why don't you tell us a little bit more about your story, how you got involved primarily in passive investing and kind of fill in the gaps that we included in the intro.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a recently departed W-2 guy after spending about 25 years in corporate America. I was in various sales and sales leadership roles in two rather large organizations, Fortune 200, Fortune 100 companies. And being around sales for the majority of that career, I have spent just a lot of time getting to know CEOs, CFOs, finance guys, things like that, and having those type of conversations. So when I started shifting away from active investing, I did buy a handful of single families. And like most of the folks probably in your audience know, like it's very, very difficult to scale and not passive at all. I started looking into passive investing in syndication model. Started out at first investing in mobile home park funds and then moved into multifamily. And then in the last year or so, I started to invest in self-storage, an ATM fund. I'm starting to look at light industrial and short-term rentals, all kinds of different things at this point. So at about 10 years into my career with my last organization, I had probably invested at that point in 15 or 16 different passive deals. And I got the nod that I didn't have to go home, but I couldn't come back and got laid off from the W-2 one more time. So fortunately, I had actually created enough passive income from all of the passive investing that I had done that I didn't have to jump back into the W-2. And it really just created a lot of options for me and my family that a lot of my peers who were not investing in the space did not have access to. So I was just extremely grateful to have spent the time investing in the real estate space because it just gave me a lot of options that others didn't have.
So there's a whole lot of folks that came out of the last recession that were maybe fearful to make that leap. They were released from their role at their Fortune 100, 500 corporate America. They've got access to their 401k and now they turn it into a self-directed and they could invest. And some of them had a sizable enough money, chunk of money that if they were to invest that they didn't have to go back. There's a fear in that as well. What if these investments don't turn out? What if they don't provide or replace the income? Tell me a little bit about your mindset and the decision-making process to say, yeah, I'm going for it. I'm all in. Maybe I don't want to go back to corporate America. You know, maybe your back's against the wall and you don't have any other choice. For some folks, what did that look like for you? And tell us how you made the decision to not, to just go full bore into passive investing, not go back and take another job.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of interesting. I'll back up a little bit because I mentioned that I worked for two large organizations and I spent about 10 years with each of them. And I got laid off from the first 10-year job, obviously, before moving into the next one. And it was a very, very different situation in that first layoff. I had a severance, but I didn't have any passive income at all. The market was kind of in flux, kind of like it is today. And it was a very, very scary time, put a lot of stress on the household, really the uncertainty of what's going to happen in this next phase. So fast forward into this next phase, and I had actually done quite a bit of work in the, call it 5 years coming up to this phase. So I'm really faced with that decision in an entirely different environment, mindset, and financial situation than I was the first time. So I had actually had set like a 5-year plan to leave my W-2 about 3 years prior to getting the final layoff notice. So I was already positioning myself to step away from corporate America in hopes of moving either one into the active space in real estate investing or some kind of hybrid combination of active / passive. So the most recent layoff just kind of sped up that process. And I knew when the day came that I got laid off that I'm probably going to move somewhat into this active space, but have kind of the bumpers of this passive income to kind of protect me. And I also had a fairly nice severance as well. So I had 6 to 12 months that I could really test this new model to see if it was really something that was going to work, or worst case scenario, fast forward a year, I'll go find another W-2 job at that point. So fortunately, the combination of the passive income combined with some more of my active income from the capital raising standpoint has really just kind of cemented the fact that I will never have to go back to W-2 ever again. So.
Well, we're heading into a phase right now, whether you believe that we're in a recession yet or heading into one in the future where there will be a whole lot of folks that will be displaced again and perhaps asked to not come back after a furlough. And yeah. We'll face with that same decision. So it's always situational, isn't it? And that's always good advice for folks to just kind of take a step back and analyze something I really want to do. Can I really do this? But at least provide some options. So now I want to go back to the fact that you've been involved in 18 total syndications now. Is that correct? I know you said you started out in 16, but where are you at right now?
Yeah. So I'm at 20.
Oh my gosh.
21. Yeah. 21 by the end of the week, probably. So yeah.
Fantastic. For us, we're active syndicators and promoters of nothing but self-storage. I've been asked to speak at some of these private equity, self-directed IRA conferences, groups, seminars, you name it. And I'm in the what I consider a fortunate position that self-storage has really outpaced just about all the other asset classes over the past 20 plus years. So it's a little bit easier. This is not an easy business. It's a full contact sport, raising capital, as you know. But being in this asset class, it does make it a little bit easier because I have a better story to tell. But I'm curious, what goes through the mind of a passive investor? You're kind of on both ends now. You've been passive and now you're helping other folks. When analyzing all things being equal across the landscape, when you're looking at a passive investment, Randy, tell us what is it that you're looking for the most? Are you choosing the asset class? Are you choosing the returns? Is it specifically the sponsor? And I know it's all of those combined, but what are you primarily looking for first? What attracts you the most that says that ticks the first box as to whether you're going to invest passively in a real estate investment?
Yeah. So first and foremost, it's always track record. I think anybody can make a deck look pretty and put performing numbers on there in a pretty Excel sheet and see what their assumptions are. But track record is number one. I don't really care what you say you're going to do. I care more what you've done because your actions actually speak louder than your PowerPoint presentation. So I think that brings up an important thing when even talking about track record. Is it track record over the last 3 years when anybody in the space can make money? Or is it track record over multiple cycles? Like I know you and your organization have been around for decades, essentially operating in this space. So that puts a big check mark, positive check in the box of due diligence in regards to track record and the operator experience for sure.
So what is the demarcation point, Randy? So as you mentioned, since 2010, everybody's had these a huge wind in their sales and at their back. This market and 50% of most people's success, and including my own, has been a gift from the market itself. Yep. But when you look back at folks like myself, as you mentioned, you know, we've been through two recessions heading into our third. You know, we've gone full cycle, we've created value and exited, but we've also done it through two recessions as well. But for you, does that mean 10 years experience, 15 years experience, 5 deals, 10 deals? What is kind of your sweet spot in terms of experience? Define for the folks here what ticks the box in terms of a minimum of experience.
At a minimum, I want to see full cycle deals, whether that be the last 5 years, 7 years, or 20 years. I want to see full cycle deals. That's kind of the minimum check mark. And then I like to see kind of the quantity of deals as well. So like, have they done 4 deals and they've had one go full cycle? I'm not as excited about that as somebody who's done 30 deals and had 10 go full cycle. So I like to see volume. I like to see boring as well. Like I want to see the same business model over and over and over and over and over. Like I will get creative with a very small portion of my investment, my dollars. Maybe that's 10%. So of my 20, I've got a couple that I would say are kind of out of the traditional box that I follow. I think it's important to have that. Now, I am of the mindset that I think track record actually is transferable between roles, between companies, between experience as well. I'm a firm believer that top performers in really any industry can translate into other industries. And yes, there will be some ramp up time, but high performing professionals generally can be high performing professionals as they move throughout their career.
Good business is good business, right?
And I mean, at the end of the day, that's it. You guys are running very large organizations, and being a guy who comes from large organizations, you can kind of sit on the sidelines and get to know people and see how they act and perform in high stressful situations, regardless of what the business model is. So yes, track record is important, but more importantly, it's the person behind the track record that really is driving that success.
Let's talk about asset classes. You've been doing this a while as well, Randy, and you get to look as we go through different economic cycles or even geographically. There's certain asset classes that are going to perform better during an economic cycle, whether it be at the bottom or at the top, or just situationally as we head into assisted living becoming more and more popular. But it also has ebbed and flowed over the past 20 years, just depending upon what's going in a market cycle and within the asset class. We're seeing, I've talked to several folks last week that are bullish on assisted living. And then I've also talked to some private equity groups that say, yeah, we just can't find any good owner operators out there. And there's too much at risk because it's such an operational business. And so for that reason, we're pulling back. So tell me from your vantage point, how have you navigated through the economic cycles from maybe geographically? And how has your mind changed with regards to different asset classes, whether it be geographically or systematically? And how do you go about, you know, making those decisions?
Yeah, I think ultimately it's a really good question. And ultimately, my exposure into the passive investing space came through Podcast University. And my very first passive investment was in a mobile home fund through a very large personality that I had been listening to their podcast for 8 or 9 years, quite frankly. So I was investing not so much in the asset class, not so much in the industry. I was investing in this individual, right? So after I spent a little bit of time in that space, I decided pretty quickly that I wanted to move into the multifamily space, probably more out of the number of opportunities and the number of operators that were there. Less about anybody that does any research about passive investing will find very quickly that self-storage is a great place to put your dollars, probably better, handles economic downturns better than multifamily, and potentially even outperforms multifamily on the upside of economic turn as well. But what I liked about multifamily was just simply the sheer number of operators, the amount of opportunity that was out there. And it's understanding that business is very, very simple to me. Like everybody knows apartments. I've lived in apartments. My dad owned apartments in LA. So I knew that space. more so than I knew others. So as my education continued to improve over the years, I started looking at asset classes like self-storage, and I'll probably start to shift more of my capital over to that space now that I've been educated and know that space more than I did in the past.
So that leads directly into my next question, which is, as an investor, no matter who you are, from Warren Buffett on down to the average daily passive investor, invests in any business that he can't understand. It has to be a simple, predictable business model, which is what self-storage is. And as you just mentioned, most people know what apartments look like because they lived in one at one point, or they see them, they've been exposed to it. There's more operators out there. And so from your standpoint, now that you begin to build a tribe, if you will, and some folks that are coming alongside of you investing with you, that does make it a little bit easier if you have the experience and also, again, some familiarity from your folks, your community that you're building as well, to be able to say yes then, versus cold storage warehouse that's located at the bottom of Mississippi. They may not be able to wrap their heads around that. And so it's just easier for you to gather more folks and for them to ultimately say yes then and part with their dollars to invest with you. So as you begin to build out your community, Randy, tell us about what are some of the places and where have you gotten the most attracting people to your tribe as you go out and invest then collectively?
Yeah, good question. And it's a question that comes up quite often because I would say in a relatively short amount of time, I've seen some pretty good success in this capital raising space and bringing some investors along this journey. So when I look back at where are these investors coming from, like almost exclusively, they are coming from very direct personal relationships that I've had and curated over the last 20 plus years through my professional career. So when I first left the W-2, I guess first and foremost, I had been very vocal about my real estate investing over the last 5 years or so. So anybody that was within shouting distance of me knew what I was doing because I'm a shout it from the mountaintop type of guy. When I'm excited about something, everybody knows about it. So that coupled with the fact that I was very high performing, high income W-2 sales guy in a very, very prolific organization with 60,000 employees. So I was able to create a brand for myself within that organization over the last 10 years. And then those relationships have just organically transferred over into this current space that I'm in. So when I first left the W-2, I reached out to the full network using some different tools that I was able to leverage. And a very common response that I heard was, Randy, either one, you did such a great job for many, many years working alongside me, or two, as my contact with this organization for many, many years, you saved me so much money, or you did such a good job for us. I'll throw any amount of, or a little bit of money at whatever it is that you're doing. So these were not cold call relationships. These were not automated lead scrubbing techniques. These were relationships I built over the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, we are social individuals and relational individuals, and we need to do our own due diligence and we will perform it. But any recommendation or proof from somebody else that is invested that we know, like, and trust, that will trump any and all due diligence that we can do on our own end. And so that is the key. That is the credibility that you need to be able to, and the social capital piece that will allow you to grow a tribe very quickly. But that doesn't mean that you don't do due diligence. And so what does that look like? Tell me a little bit about the steps and the process that you go through when you're vetting, say, an investment and or most importantly, a new sponsor, a new syndicator that you're looking to perhaps partner with and take a look at their projects and properties. You know, what are some of the steps in the due diligence process? What does that look like?
That is the number one question that I think needs to be asked of any capital raisers. What value are you bringing to the table that the investor doesn't get without you, right? So for myself, whenever I'm looking at new operators or I'm looking at new potential partners, like anything, I will have an initial call with them. I like to get a feel for the operators, get a good understanding of their track record, their expertise. But then I kind of like to sit on the sidelines and just watch and see how they perform, see how they show up, see what happens when maybe difficult things happen, and really just kind of watch those things. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, we've all heard the saying, you're betting on the jockey. And when push comes to shove, and when this operator is having to make a difficult decision about something in the business that's going to impact my returns and impact my dollars, I want to know how they're going to show up. Everybody will say that we put our investors first, but do they really put their investors first? It's just like the deck. You can put it on a deck, but when you see them in action and see them actually practicing what actually happens there. So I like to watch on the sidelines. I don't do a whole lot of let me reach out to some of your existing investors, because I think you're just like any investor can prop up one or two folks that absolutely love them and they went to high school or college with them, whatever it is, right? Like I could give you a dozen right now, right? I could probably give you 75 and I've only got 56 investors, right? So I think that's important. I think being a guy who was in sales leadership roles for 15 years or so, I got pretty good at interviewing salespeople and kind of seeing through people that are kind of fog and mirrors and that type of thing. So I like to go really deep on resumes. I like to go deep on LinkedIn. I like to look at the networks that they're connected with and kind of get some soft referrals from people that they didn't give me. And ultimately, I think if you hang around anybody long enough, they're going to show their true colors. And that's the best judgment of how they're going to be with my money, I suspect.
If you're already investing in self-storage and you're looking to grow and scale your business, then you need to join the Self-Storage Mastermind. We formed the industry's first mastermind back in 2010, and we stacked it with the one percenters across the country who specialize in acquisitions, development, and syndication. This exclusive group of storage rock stars meets once a quarter in private settings to combine business and VIP experiences that you won't find at any of the trade shows in Las Vegas or at the other copycat masterminds. So if you're looking to become part of an advanced community that openly shares best business practices, along with the largest pipeline of off-market deals and access to the top private equity resources, then you need to be in the room. So if you think you're a fit, then go to thestoragemastermind.com to apply. That's thestoragemastermind.com. And we'll see you on the inside.
Yep, 100%. And we're always prepared with the same questions that we receive from our passive investors or passive investment groups, which is, what's your secret sauce? Why do I want to follow you? What do you bring to the table versus anybody else, as you mentioned? And then in the same breath or a couple of questions later is, well, okay, so what happens if you get hit by the proverbial bus? So they want to know that you're going to be at the helm, but then what is the downside protection by way of Key Man Life Insurance or other lieutenants that you have fed into over the years so that they can continue to keep the train moving down the tracks as well, which is always important. And the piece that you and I had on the last conversation offline, how do you determine a person's integrity, the syndicator, the promoter? And you can't unless you're following them and just, as you mentioned, on the sidelines. And if you have the opportunity to peek in the window and see if there's some turmoil going on, how are they handling it? How are they showing up as a leader? And what does it look like? And that's not always easy to do. And that's where you kind of rely on somewhat referral basis, unless you can point to something in particular. And, you know, speaking for ourselves, you know, we had to remove some bad actors that were on the GP side of one of our investments. And I brought the investors to the table and I had guaranteed the notes. And so I had a vested interest. But at the end of the day, we ended up having to spend, well, choosing to spend over $300,000 to remove these folks. And that was out of my own money. So as we're going through that and the toll that took in terms of money, dollars, health, time, the mood and my interaction with family and friends at the time, you realize we were able to protect our investors, protect the investment. And that is something that we can point back to now very succinctly, but then also in these conversations now has proven to be collateral to show that here's, well, if you want to know how we showed up, here's how we showed up in this particular situation. And I would say most syndicators probably wouldn't do that. Yeah. We did it because it's the right thing to do, but also at the end of the day, we're playing the marathon because I, like you, I'm unemployable. I'm not going to go back and work for anybody else at this point. And I'm going to continue to move on. I have to protect my investors to make sure that they're going to invest with me again to move on. It is the long game that we're playing here as well, but that's the piece that, and we go to these family office groups and other events and the heads of these family offices, what are you looking for most? What is the top quality? And they'll say integrity, but it's the most difficult to be able to uncover and to be able to find, unfortunately.
Yeah. When it, and actually, if I could jump in real quick, I appreciate that you share that example as well. And not everybody has those type of examples that they can point to that talk to their integrity. I think it's important to have those. And you don't have those by showing up and going to a mentorship group and spending your 30 or 50 grand. And then all of a sudden you're a GP. Like you get that stuff through years and years of operating and going through difficult times. So I like that you shared that example and that we'll check another box on my list. As you know, I'm doing due diligence on you.
So, I didn't know, however. It's interesting. I need to remember the gentleman who coined this, but it was one of the heads of the family offices. He was on a panel at an event that I mentioned, and he was talking about syndicators that he would invest with. And he said, you know what? As a soldier, you would never follow a general unless he walked with a limp. And he said, and I would never follow a syndicator unless they had some scar tissue. And I thought that is some very, very sage advice to transfers very well, because going back to the fact that if everything's good in the past several years, everybody's making money, but how well have they done in adversity and in adverse times? And if they got the scar tissue and the stories to talk about and discuss, that's the piece that you want to pull out anytime you're looking at putting your money with somebody.
Yeah. I've asked that question with multiple operators and say, you know, tell me about a time when something didn't go as planned. And I've had multiple operators tell me, we've never had that happen. And I very politely thank them for their time and try to get on the phone as fast as possible. If you haven't been in this space long enough, quite frankly.
Right. So, yeah.
Or you're lying, one of the two.
And that comes from a person, Randy, who interviewed a lot of salespeople. When you ask the question, tell me your downfall or your most negative suit. Oh, I just work too hard and I'm too hard on myself. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for your time. So let's talk about that. Perhaps this could be from your own experience in investing around the passive side and the multiple assets that you've been involved in, the projects. What has been the worst scenario? What has been the biggest challenge that you've come across, whether it be from a syndicator or from the project itself or both?
Yeah. So I think to date, and I'm still fairly new in this space, just a few years under my belt passively, I can tell you a lot of horror stories about my active investing days. But since the goal and the focus here is passive, I will tell you that the biggest challenges I've had or issues I've run into are bad communication from sponsors when things aren't going as planned. I have a couple of deals that I've not paid distributions on, and I don't get updates as to what's going on with our dollars. I'm very uncomfortable with that. That does not seem, you know, if the original business plan was that you were going to pay distributions and you have not ever paid distributions, I think it should be something that should be over communicated over and over and over again as to what's going on. What are they doing to remedy the situation? I think probably one of the lessons I learned was investing into an organization that is maybe starting to get outside of their wheelhouse to try other avenues. And those have been the deals that have not given the results that I wanted. So that's why I like the cookie cutter. If you do B-class value add or C-class value add over and over and over again, and then I see you're doing a development deal on a hospitality thing, like that doesn't interest me at all. Like I don't want to have anything to do with that. And quite frankly, it concerns me when you start doing all these other things because it's going to pull you away from what you actually do very well. I had a situation just recently come up where some investor information was compromised. And another capital raiser was sending information to my investors. And that really concerned me. The investors that I'm bringing into deals could potentially be exposed to something like that. So watching those folks, how they responded, how quickly they respond and the actions they took tells me a lot about that operator as well. Because mistakes are going to happen. I just want to know that you're going to respond promptly and do everything you can to make it right. So I don't know if that answers the question or not.
It does. So we're active syndicators and we're also educators. And we teach people how to invest in self-storage. And we also teach people how to raise private equity to do this as well. And that is the piece, because we hear it over and over and over again, is your investors want to know where their money is going that has been put to good use. And your silence creates all kinds of stories in their minds. And if you're not communicating anything, I mean, you need to have the regular cadence of communications anyways, whether it's a monthly, even if it's just property management summary report that has been summarized from the facility, and then quarterly, a lengthier narrative and pictures and updates, and perhaps a webinar where there's some Q&A as well. We hold those and hardly anybody shows up, but they're there. And that's what folks want to see. But the minute that you don't schedule a quarterly webinar, or if you miss by a week monthly report, then all of a sudden people think, oh, he's gone to Belize and he watched the Madoff show on Netflix and got a bunch of ideas with our money. And that is part of that human nature. But then when things aren't going well, we no longer, I mean, we may delay that and we may have minimized that very early on in our career. And then we realized that was a wrong move to make, and nothing nefarious, and not that we weren't hiding anything, but we also recognize now that when things go bad and if there is something and we miss the mark or something has happened, now we immediately communicate, because quite honestly, it's a selling opportunity for us now. Because at the end of the project, if we hit our marks, if we exceeded the projections, or even if we fell short, we can point directly back, and they can point directly back to the time when we said, hey guys, this just happened. Here's the ramifications. We're doing everything, or there's nothing we can do. And sorry, but let's wait 7, 8, 9, 14 months from now and see where this ends up. They'll remember that. And even if we didn't hit the mark and it was something that was perhaps even an oversight on our end, those folks will reinvest with us because we were upfront, because we were honest about it. We exposed it and we communicated it to them. And so for any syndicators that are listening out there, or you're looking to get into the private equity side of the business, there's no such thing as over communication. And at any time, especially when a problem comes up, that is truly an opportunity to be able to show that you have integrity and that you're going to show up as the leader that day and own up, or just report, depending on the situation. But that is going to pay you back tenfold on the back end. And so don't be fearful or think that you need to hide or mitigate anything. Things happen. It is business, and it's not 100%. It's not a direct path to profitability. There's going to be moves along the way. You just need to communicate those to your investors. Otherwise, they won't come back.
Yeah, no, thank you. Very well said. And I think there are times when I've dealt with operators and a lot of times they want to point fingers at other folks that are the cause for it. And I think it's important as stewards of investor capital, the onus lies on you. Because ultimately, we're investing dollars with this specific operator. So I don't ever like to hear people say, well, this person was a problem or this happened or this. Like, tell me what you're doing to fix it. I want to hear that you have ownership in the problem and that you're going to do everything you can to make sure it doesn't happen again in the future. So yeah, good stuff.
There's a reason why I have listened to Jocko Willink's book, Extreme Ownership, twice now. And that is because at the end of the day, it's on me no matter what. Either I didn't prepare for the situation, I didn't prepare my people. And regardless of even if I did all that stuff, I still own it. I got to apologize for it anyways, because you're the syndicator and you put yourself out there. And if you don't think you aren't responsible for everything or that you can shirk that responsibility or point to somebody or something else, at the end of the day, the buck does stop with you. All right. So in the time that we have left, Randy, tell me, has your strategy shifted or changed in 2023 from where you were in the past? Are you looking at things differently right now? Are you moving faster? Are you moving slower? Have you pivoted in general? What does the strategy look like for the balance of this year?
Yeah, good question. And yes, it has evolved. But again, my business is very, well, depending on whether we're talking about my passive investing strategy or my capital raising strategy, and really both have evolved. With the goal of my real estate investment firm is that I want to be able to put multiple deals in front of my investors, at least one per month. I want to be able to provide diversification across operators, deals, geographies, and asset classes. So as I'm growing my business, I have this tendency to slow down as I start to get momentum based out of fear. So I'm working very hard on trying to push through that fear and doubling down and leaning in, because there is a lot of value in growth through momentum as well. So from the business growth standpoint, I'm just investing very heavily in the business, investing in myself and my mindset to make sure that I can grow this thing and do the right thing for my investors and provide the right opportunities for them. So from a passive investing standpoint, yes, I am trying to, this balancing act of trying to gain diversification across asset classes, markets, all of this other stuff, but without getting too spread thin and becoming almost like a generalist, I think. I think it's ideal setting. I will personally have three or four operators across maybe a few asset classes that I will invest much heavier in, because I think, and I can't remember who says it, but like keeping all your eggs in one basket and watching it very, very closely or diversifying across others. I think the answer truly is actually a mix of that, because I don't want to have too much exposure in my own investing dollars with any one operator to where if some bad actor situation were to come up that 25% of my net worth is gone because of a situation like that. So I think it's really kind of a blend of having two or three or maybe four operators that I work very, very closely with and put almost all of my capital with.
Well, I think that's wise. And again, as we look at the landscape of the family offices and some of the larger groups, they are diversifying a bit. So looking at some of the other asset classes, those which do well during a recession, but then also spreading across a couple different operators, and they're deploying smaller amounts of capital. So before they maybe had two or three operators and they're doubling down and sent large amounts of money to those projects. Now they're scaling back just a bit in terms of the dollar amount allocation and going into others as well. And so I can always look at the models of other folks that are coming up before us that have more years of experience and that are deploying more capital just to see where the market is heading. And that's kind of what we're seeing as well. So I think that's a wise move on your part. So with that, Randy, and one other thing to add on to, you had mentioned that sometimes maybe you move a little slow and you step back when that momentum begins, that you get to maybe a little fearful. And what we've talked to our folks about, not necessarily our passive investors, but on the active side, the folks that we mentor and coach that are just part of our community, is if it makes sense right now and you've run it through and you've appropriately applied the cost of capital in your capital stack and you've looked at your exit and you've got feasibility studies to support stuff, now is the time when everybody else is rushing out that you should be going in. Doesn't mean that you rush in and make foolish decisions, but we also know that it's during these times where most of the wealth has been created is during a recession and we were nearing or at the bottom of the market. And so take that for what it's worth, Randy. That's my little tidbit for you. But for the rest of the folks here, tell us, in the years that you've been doing this, you're 3 or 4 years behind, you've been through several cycles, a number gives you a unique perspective to look at this from the passive side as well as the active side. How would you approach the market, or how would you advise, or what type of advice would you have for folks that are approaching this market right now from a passive standpoint?
Yeah, from a passive standpoint, I like to suggest that folks dip their toe first, in any situation, put in the minimum or half the minimum on your first deal, get comfortable with the process, try to spread your dollars across a couple of different operators and a couple of different deals and a couple of, like, if somebody came to me and they've got 250 grand to put in a deal, I'm going to tell them, let's put 50 grand into five deals. Let's not put it all into one. I think there's a lot of learning and education that can occur by seeing how different operators act. So that being said, I am shifting more and more of my capital from the stock market over into real estate. A lot of people are saying now's not the time to pull the money out of the stock market. I wholeheartedly believe that my dollars sitting in a syndication are better than sitting in the stock market. Even if the thing were to rebound and get back to where it was at the beginning of last year, it's not going to be able to continue 20% year over year for the next 5 to 7 to 10 years. Yeah. So shifting more into that space. And then also a strategy I like to use with folks is, and you've talked about it and alluded to it a little bit, is about using old 401k or self-directed accounts to really test the waters. The challenge there is at some point you got to get cash into these deals, because otherwise you're still going to be handcuffed by the 401k and this, the IRA rules. It's a great way to learn this space, but it doesn't create a livable income for you. So it's important to maybe test the water there and then start investing with actual cash capital, because you can actually live on those returns. So,
Appreciate it. All right, Randy, Impact Equity is the name of the company, and The Gentle Art of Crushing It is the podcast. What are the best ways that people can begin to follow you and get in touch with you if they would choose to?
Yeah, so those two ways. I do spend a lot of time on LinkedIn. That is where the majority of my investors hang out, as and myself as well. But the podcast has been really fun getting to connect with folks like yourself and a lot of the other big players. And then, of course, impactequity.net. I've got a free giveaway on the website, top 10 questions to ask investors. And I'm actually going to do a passive investor guide here shortly as well. So those are the best places to find me.
Fantastic. Randy Smith, so good to connect with you again. Thank you so much for your time and sharing your wisdom from mostly the passive, but also the active side as well. Appreciate you.
I appreciate it, Scott. Thanks so much.
All right, take care.
Hey, gang, wait. Three things before you leave. First, don't forget to subscribe to the Self Storage Podcast and turn on your notifications so you never miss another episode. And while you're there, please leave us a 5-star review if you like the show. Second, be sure to share your favorite episodes and more via Instagram, and don't forget to tag us. And lastly, head to the links in the show description and hit the following subscribe button on Twitter and Facebook to get a front row seat as we grow and scale our business and bring you along with us. Take care.